Hello there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare and science in the news, and answers to your questions via email and phone. I'll be giving out those phone numbers in just a few moments. But before I do so, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So, it's been quite a week. I had a wonderful time last week off at the American Academy of Medical Acupuncture, and I know I threw a lot of science at you with that program, and I'm ready to follow up and answer questions about all of that microRNA stuff that went out last week and went up last Friday, if you're a podcast listener, just yesterday. However, the first thing I want to talk about is a little story about healthy eating. And, you know, we've been trying to combat the childhood obesity epidemic. Unfortunately, cooking is rapidly becoming a lost art, and many children eat one or more restaurant meals a day. Really quite a shift from what things were like 20 or 30 years ago. And restaurants are in competition with each other. They need to make their food taste good. This also goes for any kind of processed food that's sold on the open market. And tasting good, well, basically involves getting a whole bunch of people in a room and giving them a bunch of different versions of the same recipe to taste and having them vote on which one they like better. Unfortunately, we humans are all hardwired to prefer fat and sweet and salt. Which, well, you could argue that there's some nutritional value there, but ultimately it's too much of the wrong kind of nutrition, that is to say empty calories. And as a result, we have systematically trained one or two generations to prefer foods that are bad for them. Now, the only way to turn that around is to change availability. A restaurant chain called the Silver Diner made some changes in its menu in April of 2012. And a recent study that was presented at the Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine showed a real substantial change in what people were ordering. Now, one of the things that they did in changing their menu, and I thought this was, you know, really excellent, was they took fries and soda drinks off of the children's menu. They were still available at the restaurant, but you had to ask for them. This is basic child rearing 101. Jimmy, do you want apple juice, orange juice, or tomato juice? Not Jimmy, do you want apple juice or Coca-Cola? And of course, if Jimmy is really in control of the family dynamic, he'll figure out how to get his Coca-Cola. But for many children, you could change their behavior by simply limiting the options that were available and encouraging them to make those choices. Another thing this restaurant did, which I thought was extremely good, was that they automatically include side dishes that were healthy. So, for example, strawberries, mixed vegetables, or a side salad were the default option. You didn't have to ask for them. And if you wanted something else, it was available at no extra charge, but you had to ask for it. These simple changes, well, essentially, people go with the default option, right? And so what happened was that if you looked at the nutritional standards set by the National Restaurant Association's Kids Live Well program, and these are basic nutritional standards for vitamins, calorie content, etc., the number of meals that were served at these restaurants that met those standards was almost 60%, up from 20% before the changes. So, not too surprising, if you change what's on the menu, you change what people order. But the magnitude of the change, a 300% improvement in childhood nutrition, well, that's something to really think about. I'm going to talk a little bit about a story of market manipulation and generic drugs. Now, The FDA is charged with protecting us and making sure that drugs are safe and effective. And the FDA's charter starts sometime in the late 1930s, early 1940s, I believe. And I may be off on that date, but that's hardly the point of this story. There were a lot of drugs already out there at the time that this charter begins. And many of those drugs were simply grandfathered in. In other words, they are generally assumed to be safe and effective. They're already in use. There are literally tens of thousands of people taking them. We'll not make those drugs prove themselves right now, just new drugs. And later on, we'll get back and we'll make those drugs validate themselves. Well, in 2009, the FDA got around to making a drug called colchicine prove that it was effective. And the company that took that on was Mutual Pharmaceutical Company, now taken over by Takeda Pharmaceuticals. And they did the work, okay? They did. They went and they did the research and they spent the money. And the FDA's approval of the special version of colchicine, a drug used in gout very widely, gave Takeda the exclusive marketing rights for 3 years for gout and 7 years for familial Mediterranean fever. Well, Mutual Pharmaceutical Company then sued other manufacturers of colchicine, claiming that they were falsely implying that their products were FDA approved, and the FDA ordered those companies to pull their colchicine from the market because they were unapproved drugs. So something that had been working for 60 years was suddenly an unapproved drug, except for this exclusive manufacturer who'd gone through the steps. Okay. Guess what happened to the price? Well, I'm sure you can guess what happened to the price, but maybe you don't realize how much it changed. Colchicine went from 10 cents a pill to $5 a pill. And this is something that people might take once a day. So you can do the math, $150 a month from $3 a month. A lot of people simply had to go off the drug and suffer. All right, well, it's only 3 years, so along about 2014, now that Colchris no longer has exclusive marketing rights, the FDA grants approval to a company called Hikma to market and sell another form of colchicine for prevention of gout attacks. And before this drug could be launched, Takeda Pharmaceuticals sued them. They obtained a temporary restraining order against the sale, and they simultaneously sued the FDA in a separate proceeding for approving a drug, which is, of course, the FDA's prerogative, but Takeda sued on some sort of technical procedural ground. Now, this is called tying you up in court while you continue to make an unreasonable profit on a medication. So finally, we are now halfway through 2015, and finally, these lawsuits, these frivolous lawsuits that bought Takeda Pharmaceuticals lots more profits, way more than paid for the lawyer's fees, are gone. And you are now able to get a generic form of colchicine, which promises to be cheap and effective, we hope. And that brings us to our second issue, but I see that we have a caller who wants to talk about generic drugs, so we're going to go straight to the caller and start the conversation. By the way, we're going now to Lee in Santa Cruz. Hello, Lee. You're on the air.
Oh, hi. Thanks. I'm a protein stone former. I've been on Thiola for 25 years through the VA, and it controls my stones pretty well. Last Friday, I got a call from the VA that they couldn't get my medication anymore because there was some sort of a precursor problem. And I did an awful lot of research over the weekend. Bottom line is I'm back on my meds because I talked to the manufacturer directly. But I ran across an article in Forbes about this particular drug. Last September, they turned it over because it's now generic. Am I still on?
You're still on. Your voice got weird for a second, but we're good.
I just heard it's a strange beep. When Mission Pharmaceutical turned this over to Retropin to sell, now that it's generic, they were giving over a drug that they were selling for $1.30 a pill. And Retropin immediately raised the price to $30 a pill. and there's no way for anybody to do anything about it because they did it because they could. There are about 90,000 patients worldwide with my disease, so we don't have any kind of a lobby or anybody who's really interested in us at all. I spoke with a friend of mine who's been consulting to Big Pharma. He says this is a huge problem, that it's all about offshoring manufacturing, and that there's real problems of getting the quality medications back in, that arthritis medication is getting into this problem, pain medication is having this problem in terms of obscene price raises because they can. My friend thinks that this will, in fact, bankrupt Medicare. The other little anecdotal story is a friend of his bought the company that developed the drug that actually cures hepatitis C, and my friend Mike was in the room when they were pricing the medication.
Oh, God, I would have loved to have been a fly on the wall in that board room.
The question asked was, what does it cost to have a liver transplant? And the answer came back, $100,000 to $120,000, and the owner of the company says, then we're going to sell our drug for $80,000. He has since sold the company for $11 billion, and he's cruising the world with his family.
Well, let me tell you, we live in a country where the word regulation has become a dirty word along the level of liberal and feminist and other untouchable things. We have, and we need regulation. We need it because if we don't have it, this sort of thing is going to kill people, and that's just not okay. As far as I'm concerned, it's really not okay. And another thing, and I was just about to talk to this, so thank you for calling in. I really appreciate it, Lee, is that the new industry thing is buy up the generic companies. There are lots of generic companies out there, or there used to be, and now what's happening is a massive market consolidation where generic big organizations are buying up multiple generic companies with drugs that have a broad distribution. Yours is kind of an exception, but the same thing, obviously, because you're over a barrel. Kidney, painful kidney stones, you're going to pay just to probably anything not to have a kidney stone. There are no regulators for this. The scrutiny for these purchases is not under the FDA. I'm not sure who regulates commerce at the level of mergers and acquisitions, but they are not looking at the implications of these sorts of shifts. And this is blatant monopolistic practices that they're getting away with.
The Forbes article suggested that an insurance company with 100 patients countrywide having this particular drug as part of their health care, that their price per year went from $543,000 to $10.9 million just for this one change in price.
I'm sorry, could you please repeat that? I want to be sure I heard that right. It went from
the Forbes article set up a scenario suggesting that an insurance company having 100 patients countrywide taking this drug at $1.30 a pill, that their annual expense for these 100 patients would be about $543,000 a year. But with the price change to $30 a pill, that for the same 100 patients for a year's worth of medication would become $10.9 million.
When they passed Medicare Part D, they embedded a poison. Well, it wasn't a poison pill because it got passed, but Medicare is statutorily prohibited from negotiating with pharmaceutical companies. We need to rescind that. That'll solve a lot of this because Medicare can say, we will not, we control the Medicare formulary and we won't pay for it, period. That would solve a lot of it. That would turn it into a negotiation, because if you can't sell your product to Medicare, or if Medicare said, you know, you're charging us too much, we're going to go buy it from Canada. Medicare could buy it in Canada. They could buy it in France or Italy or Great Britain. We can't, or if we do, we run the risk of getting some bogus thing that's transshipped from, you know, a mailbox in Birmingham that actually comes from Dubai, from, let's say, India. And maybe India's fine and maybe it's not. And we have no way of knowing what we're getting. Plus, there's a huge market in counterfeit drugs out there. And unless you're going to run the drug through mass spectrometer, you're not going to be able to tell if it's the real thing or a clever counterfeit. So we've got a horrible situation going here.
My particular situation is that my drug costs would go from 20, if I had to buy it directly, my drug costs would go from about $2,200 a year to $67,500. So I could sell my house, live in my car, get 2 years worth of medication for the equity I have in my house, and in the third year, I'd be living in my car and not be able to afford my medication.
Lee, I'm going to leave it there because you have most eloquently stated the quandary, and we have a few other people calling in. So let me thank you for chiming in. Have a great day, and just so very glad that you are, in fact, not having to sell your house to buy your meds. Have a great day.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Let's go now to Valerie in San Juan Bautista. Hello, Valerie. You're welcome to the program.
Thank you, Dr. Dawn. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I have a friend whom I'm trying to help with their GI problem. And, you know, as many times as I've listened to your program and I've heard all this stuff about GI, I say, oh, God, why can't I bring up something in my brain to tell them? And so I'm concerned about this person doesn't seem to have a particular trigger to a problem of not particularly cramping, but lots of diarrhea.
Mm-hmm.
He's on schedule to get a scope mechanism done. But otherwise, he's just at odds with what the heck to do. And so I've suggested ancient grains,
right,
curry,
right, exactly.
Exactly. Cinnamon.
Let me tell you a little story, okay?
Yeah.
First of all, as you might imagine, being a pre-medical student, worrying you're going to get into medical school, then getting into medical school and having this huge, vast quantity of information that you are trying to assimilate, and then being a medical intern and then resident, that's a real stressful decade right there. And you tend to pull a lot of all-nighters, have a lot of stress hormones. Maybe you don't eat as well as you might, or you might pick several foods that are easy and eat a lot of those, which is a very typical behavior when people are crunched. And it's the combination of having a tendency towards allergies, hay fever, sinusitis, that sort of thing, having stress, and having a monotonous diet is likely to lead to a food sensitivity. And sometimes they can be very unusual. Personal anecdote, because I can reveal I can tell my own stories without violating confidentiality, is that I turned out to get sensitized to watermelon while I was in medical school. I used to eat a lot of it while I studied, and we are talking a lot. I'd probably go through a whole watermelon in a couple of days. It helps to eat while you study, and I was looking for something, you know, that I thought would be reasonably healthy. By the time I was a resident several years later, I would get these erratic bouts of cramping and diarrhea. I thought it was stress. I was under a lot of stress, but they were really intermittent. One day I finally made the connection and stopped eating watermelon, and my symptoms went away. And several years later, someone accidentally slipped me some watermelon in a fruit smoothie, and bam, within 40 minutes, I was, worshiping at the porcelain altar. So it's a real thing. Okay, this food sensitivity stuff. Now, I tested my antibodies some years recently, and I don't have IgG antibodies against watermelon, but I have some sort of intolerance reaction of one of the other five mechanisms for that are possible, and it's not a food I can tolerate. This can happen with food preservatives. It can happen with artificial dye red number 16 or whatever. So your friend, if it's really truly intermittent and out of the blue, may never figure it out directly. But what I advise is when he gets this reaction, stop and write down everything you ate for the last 6 or 7 hours, and then if it anything processed or restaurant, go and get the entire list of ingredients and put it into a database. And then the next time it happens, you do the same thing. And after 4 or 5 times, you may come up with a common single X factor. Another an alternative, of course, if it's more frequent, is to do an elimination diet. If you go to my website, askdrdawn.com, and you can spell out doctor or just use DR, and go to the resources page, there's a link to an elimination diet. When I approach a patient with this sort of history, the first thing I do is ask them to eliminate the usual suspects. And it's kind of like your basic crime investigation. Who are the usual perpetrators? Let's sequester them and see if the crime happens again, and then we have to dig deeper. But a lot of times, just going with the usual suspects will nail the answer. So something like corn over a certain level or wheat over a certain level, and you can test negative for celiac and you can test negative for IgG antibodies and still have a wheat reaction. So unfortunately, these tests are useful if they're positive, but they're not useful if they're negative. And ultimately, it's a trial and error process. If it were a more frequent problem in an older person, let's say older means above 50, I'd be looking at stomach acid and I'd be looking at the pancreatic enzymes that break down fat, because as we age, those things definitely don't work as well. And if you eat a high fatty meal, you may get cramping and diarrhea, even though you don't have gallstones. And so your doctor won't tell you not to eat a high-fat meal because he'll do the ultrasound and say, oh, you don't have gallstones. That's not it. But that could be a mistake. So that's how I would approach it. It is a complex and difficult problem, but there is a way out, and that's kind of the roadmap for it.
Wow. Perfect. Perfect. I just needed to be reminded of all those things that you have touched on from time to time on your program.
And pull it all together.
I'll go to the elimination diet. It did come into my brain, and I said, you know, well, then where do I search?
Now you know. And actually, just, you know, to talk about the website for a moment, we put every program up there, and my producer, Charles Mansky, goes through and puts topics, and that you can scan the topics, and they're pretty good. So you can find those shows. Oh, I remember last month there was something. You can find it pretty quickly. Maybe a 5-minute scan search on your own will turn it up. And also the interviews. If you haven't gone through the archives and listened to the interviews, there are, for any kind of topic like gastrointestinal issues, there'll be some really good interviews that may pull it all together for you. And so those would be just a couple of things. No matter what happens, we're going to keep that Ask Dr. Dawn site up and current and going. So we created that as a resource for listeners and sometime listeners and people who just randomly ran across this on a podcast search. It's there for you. That's the labor of love piece.
Besides, that's awesome. Really awesome.
All right. Well, thank you very much for the call, and I hope that I've helped your friend.
Other comment.
Yes.
Last week, your program, listening to all that science on genetics and DNA, and fabulous, just fabulous. Thank you so much for doing that.
Thank you very much. I was a little, it was a challenge to try and make it assimilatable to, you know, somebody without a PhD degree in molecular biology. So I'm so glad to hear that you enjoyed it. Thank you.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
Bye-bye. Bye. Our next caller is an anonymous one in Santa Cruz. Hello, anonymous.
Yes, hi, thank you. I have an illness that I won't go into, but I had a dream that I think represents something that's going on. And I want your opinion medically on how to interpret, if you could interpret this little snippet.
All right.
Okay?
Go ahead.
In the dream, I don't know if I hear noise, but I go downstairs in my house, which is like my body, and in the living room, there are these two men. They're uninvited guests. They're uninvited, but they're helpers. They're here to fix, do some handy work and fix things that are broken in my home, my house. Only they're uninvited. I told them that I needed them, but I needed to have made an appointment, and they just barged in. They weren't invited. And they weren't doing the work. They were sitting on my couch and chair and just talking. And there was a ladder that was just laying on the floor.
This is why you want to be home when the contractor comes, right?
Okay. So if this home is my body,
mm-hmm.
It's not like it's pathogens because they're good beings, but they weren't doing their job and they were uninvited. The ladder was on the floor. And so I'm wondering if you would interpret that.
Well, you know, I have to say that in over 20 years of doing a radio call-in show, this is the first time anyone's asked me to interpret a dream. So I'm just pleased that the breadth of experience that I've had in my life continues to expand. That I don't need to acknowledge that. Now, dreams are, as we currently understand them scientifically, they are the process of consolidation of experience and learning. So it's as if you walk in, it's as if at night when you're asleep, you have a pile of random papers that have been dumped on your desk in your inbox, and you have a series of pigeonholes, and you pick one up and look at it and go, okay, that belongs there. Oh, this belongs there. And so it's thought that it provides a kind of processing and consolidation function, and that's how what memory is doing. Okay, so if we accept that this is processing and consolidation, then we would say that something has happened in your world, in your conscious life, that might have triggered either concern about an illness, or it could actually be concern about a leak in the roof or something. But I mean,
right.
So you're already thinking this is, you know, my body that's being worked on.
And I work with dreams a lot, but yeah. I don't know medically.
So what's your illness?
It's too complicated. It has not been diagnosed.
Okay.
You once gave me an idea, which was wonderful, about internal wind.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so let's go with this idea that your subconscious knows something,
right?
That you consciously have not are not aware of. But there is a repair that needs to be made, and this may just be a wish. So it's possible that your subconscious is wishing.
It doesn't feel that way, though. That's what I'm just asking. Mm-hmm. If there isn't anything that jumps out at you about...
Without knowing okay. Your background illness, and I understand that you don't necessarily want to put that out there, and that's fine, or can't put it out there either way. Just in vague generalities, I would say where I would go with this would be some sort of free associative process that might allow for your subconscious to communicate. So I'm a great believer in art therapy. So there's...
I just want like a literal interpretation from a doctor around, you know, helper cells or helper things that aren't doing their work.
Well, you basically have your immune system, you have your fibroblasts, right. You have your stem cell lines. And so, again, that's where the context comes in. But
okay.
The place that I would go to seek more information would be, you know, either drawing, you know,
right.
Blindfold with clay. you know,
so
put
you
a blank.
No, I just meant the literal.
No, literally, you know, it's
from a medical point.
From a medical point of view, I think it isn't. I don't have the background information to help.
Okay.
All right. Okay. Thanks for the interesting question, though.
Yes, thank you.
You're welcome. Bye bye. So I'm going to go to this email from Fred in North Carolina. I think this will be of interest to many of the listeners. Dear Dr. Don, I'm an early 60s male with two issues, anxiety and brain fog. My grown son shares the same afflictions, and a brother who was diagnosed with obsessive compulsive disorder, frequently complicated by being spaced out. We both experience the commonly cited symptoms of brain fog, including forgetfulness, confusion, lack of focus, in other words, a general lack of mental clarity. It is sometimes accompanied by a general feeling of lethargy, and at times it can be difficult to focus enough to get through the working day. I want to emphasize that lethargy. Don't forget that one. We have noticed that caffeine, including soda pop and coffee, can increase the sensation. In other words, caffeine seems to dull our brain rather than increase focus. A good night's sleep doesn't seem to change the intensity of the fog. It's like I'm not always here in the moment. We've read that there could be many causes for any person's brain fog, including drug side effects, food and environmental allergies, lack of restful sleep, which we've just heard may hasten the onset of mental impairment, hormonal imbalances, mental conditions such as anxiety, depression, OCD, thyroid, and even Lyme disease. All true, Fred, all true. Can you provide us and our fellow sufferers with some suggestions for dealing with the fog? Being on the East Coast, we can't enjoy your program live on the radio, but we do listen to every podcast. And please tell Lyle, Bonnie, and Ben and the other geeks that we also enjoy listening to Geek Speak, KUSP's Technology Roundtable, which immediately follows your program each Saturday morning. So, Fred, before I go forward, I do want to say that both the geeks and I are committed to continuing the podcast, so at least for the foreseeable future. So, in our case, you can go to KUSP.org. You can go to the Geeks website. You can, which is geekspeak.org, or you can go to my website, which is askdrdon.com, and find those podcasts in the future. So, even if they're no longer distributed through NPR, which I'm not sure that will continue. All right. So coming back to your question, obviously there's some hereditary factor here. With all three males having it, it certainly does suggest the possibility of a Y chromosome problem, although that certainly isn't, definitive. Everybody should check their thyroid and make sure that that's fine, because that is just such a common problem. And low-level hypothyroidism, and that could be a normal TSH at the upper end, can, in some people, have a profound effect on mental clarity. You don't mention that there's early senility or dementia in your family, so I'm going to assume that's not the case. Where I would start with is try something simple. Try eliminating gluten and dairy. So all wheat and gluten-containing products, which is a lot of the grains, and dairy for about a month. In some people, there's a transformation from gut flora of these compounds into compounds called gluteomorphins and caseomorphins. And these are compounds that do cross the blood-brain barrier and can, in fact, give you a problem. They can give you brain fog, common enough in the American diet such that you could be eating them every day and you might be fueling this. So a one-month trial just to see if... Oh, and also no booze during that 1 month, just to see if things improve. While you're doing that, you might want to throw in a B complex, something that contains methylcobalamin and methylfolate. A lot of people, and I mean a lot, up to 10% of the population, have mutations in their methylation pathways. And if you take pre-methylated products, such as the ones I just mentioned, the methylated B vitamins, and also maybe a methyl donor, like betaine, which is trimethylglycine, you could conceivably see an improvement of brain function. Another thing I would throw in if that's not successful, is membrane support. And membrane support for the brain is basically make those cell walls very, very fluid. And you do that by increasing your dietary DHA to about 2,000 milligrams. That's a subset of omega-3 You have to take a lot of pills to get 2,000 milligrams of DHA. But again, do it for about a month, see if there's an improvement. And either take lecithin, about 3 tablespoons a day, or take about 500 to 1,000 milligrams of phosphatidylserine and phosphatidylcholine. These are two other membrane constituents that increase membrane fluidity. The thing that makes your neuron work is these receptors reading neurotransmitters that are being delivered across the synapse. That receptor has to literally pivot in the cell membrane in order to activate the synapse. So if you have a thick, stiff cell membrane, it can have an effect on your thought processes. Now, if these two natural things don't work, and I would encourage you to try these things in order, there is a pharmaceutical called selegiline, which is often thought of as sort of the master nootropic. Nootropics are drugs that improve brain function. It's an MAOB inhibitor, which means it interferes with the breakdown of norepinephrine and dopamine. And it is a safe MAO. There are other MAO inhibitors that are sometimes used for depression, have really severe food-drug interactions, and you can get into some serious trouble with them. But selegiline doesn't cause those kind of interactions. And it's been shown in multiple studies, including studies in mice that are essentially mutated deliberately to develop Alzheimer's disease-like conditions, to be neuroprotective. So I'm not going to give out doses on that. This you would need to work with the doctor on, but that would probably be the step three where I would go. And I think if you, in North Carolina, you could probably find someone doing this sort of work at the Capitol. You might have to do a little traveling, but it could be worth it for you if these other natural remedies that I've already discussed don't get you anywhere. This email from Tariq in New Jersey. Thyroid. Hi, my wife has hypothyroid. She's getting levothyroxine 125 micrograms daily. According to Mr. John Bergman, who's a chiropractor, if anybody has low stress, healthy gut, healthy water, healthy food, they have good thyroid function. My question is, after having thyroid disease, can someone have a normal thyroid function again if they change their lifestyle back to healthy? Thank you very much. Well, Tariq, I want to emphasize that a lot of people out there with hypothyroidism, and I don't know what proportion it is, let's say 10%, are people who actually had a viral thyroid infection that made them hypothyroid, and they went to the doctor because they were sluggish and cold, and the doctor tested them and found indeed that their thyroid was low, and so made the diagnosis and started them on medication. And a virus will knock out the thyroid gland for a couple of months, and then the gland comes back, but in the meantime, you may have been placed on medication appropriately, but then the gland recovers and is actually capable of taking over. But because you continue on the medication, the stimulus from the brain to make thyroid is never delivered to the gland. And so essentially your gland is in a drug-induced state of hibernation. The way that you test for this is to gradually drop the dose of thyroid under a doctor's observation. Please don't do this. Children, don't try this at home. But you gradually drop the dose and you watch to see if the levels of T3 and T4 start to rise as the levels drop. And that means that you still have active gland. The TSH will go up, and often that's all doctors check. But you don't look at the TSH in this situation. You want the TSH to go up because you're trying to wake up a sleepy gland. So you let the TSH go up and you watch to see whether or not those thyroid levels start to bump. And if they do, then you drop the dose further and you watch to see how much gland recovery you can get. Because you can often cut the dose in half or even eliminate it entirely. Often, yeah, 1 out of 10. So it's not half. And a lot of people have autoimmune thyroid disease and they've damaged the gland because their antibodies have attacked it. You can test for this. The tests are anti-thyroid peroxidase and anti-microsomal antibody. And if these are elevated, then the chances of being able to get, with healthy lifestyle, get off of thyroid medication are pretty slim. And I generally don't advise people to try it if they have at levels of circulating antibody. If they don't, then there is a chance that their hypothyroidism was a viral illness that they have recovered from and that they are in fact suppressing the gland. So it's worth a try. But again, children, don't try this at home. We talked a little bit last week or the week before, I guess that was the April 11th show, about repetitive strain injury. And we had a caller, John in Santa Barbara, rather a writer, emailer, John in Santa Barbara, sent this. You had a caller that mentioned a repetitive motion injury from computer and mouse work. I work as a CAD operator and have had the same problems in the past. One thing I found to help, not mentioned, is to learn how to use a mouse, preferably a symmetrically shaped mouse, with the opposite hand. It took me a couple of weeks to become proficient, but the relief to the other hand was well worth it. If I ever start to feel my right hand stressing, I can switch over to the left. Yes, the idea with repetitive strain injury is to eliminate the repetition. If you can stop repeating the strain, then often the pain will go away. So thank you, John in Santa Barbara, for an additional suggestion. Another regular writer, this one Judith in Atlanta, writes, I appreciate your extremely useful wisdom. I've been a listener for years. I'm a 63-year-old woman who began taking probiotics about 18 months ago and noticed shortly after I started taking them that I had stopped having urinary leakage. I then heard you tell another caller that her use of probiotics had nothing to do with her urinary incontinence improvement. That was on the April 11th show, but I made the connection. You had a segment on UTIs in which you recommended lactobacillus. Yes, indeed, I did. I checked my probiotics, and the ones I take are made up of that species. I take 4 a day, or about 16 billion, but it's made a wonderful difference in my life. So thank you, Judith. I had never read in the scientific literature about improvements of urinary incontinence. So this is one of those anecdotal things that is one of the great blessings for me of doing this program, is that my listeners often provide me with ideas that I'm able to implement in my medical practice and pass forward, transmit both on the program. And so I will say I have not looked for this, so I haven't seen it, but I shall certainly look for it in the future, and I will come back to you with my perspective on whether it was helpful and for how many people. And in the meantime, those of you who wish to give it a try for your urinary incontinence, I would say it certainly is a legitimate thing to try, and I would not consider it to be in any way dangerous. It will probably help. We have a related email. I'm going to bounce to this from an anonymous writer in Central California who wanted to know about hormone replacement therapy using the E-string and some alarming side effects that they had read about. They didn't specify the alarming side effects, but I'm assuming it was probably the endometrial cancer and the other things that were listed when I went to the website and looked at potential side effects. And I want to throw this out because this has happened several times in the last few months where people have said, oh, estrogen replacement therapy causes blood clots, causes heart attack, causes stroke, causes breast cancer. And when you look at the package inserts, that's what it says. The science actually doesn't say that. The science is much more nuanced, but the FDA has kind of got a rubber stamp sort of thing that needs to go into all estrogen replacement therapy. My take on it is that how you deliver the estrogen makes a huge difference on the blood clots, and the science backs me up. Blood clots are associated with oral estrogen. If you put it in your mouth, the dose that's required is large. It goes from the stomach and intestines into the liver, where in the process of getting rid of 90% of the estrogen and deactivating it immediately, some toxic byproducts are made that have been shown to be associated with breast cancer in laboratory and rat studies. And furthermore, the liver changes. You actually cause more of certain enzymes to be made. And one of the effects of these changes is that the body makes, the liver makes more blood clotting factors. That's one of the jobs of the liver, is to keep your blood clotting. And so this increase in blood clotting factors is not seen with topical estrogens, typically given at a much lower dose. And a vaginal ring would count as topical estrogens. So I actually feel like this is a legitimate and safe therapy, topical estrogen, that is. If you're going to just treat vaginal symptoms, you might try the probiotics that Judith in Atlanta suggested. But if you were going to use a pharmaceutical agent, compounded estriol, which is sometimes called E3, is the end breakdown estrogen. And this one does not stimulate breast receptors. So if I'm going to treat vaginal dryness, I use estriol. That's estriol, not estradiol, which is the pharmaceutical cream, which can stimulate, potentially stimulate the growth of breast cancer. Certainly breast cancer cells in vitro will grow if you add estradiol, that they won't grow when you add estriol. Whether or not that happens in the body, that's a big debate and not one that we can possibly answer at this time. Let's go to one last caller, and that is Anne in Santa Cruz. Hello, Anne. Welcome.
Thanks for taking my call. And I also want to say, as many have, that your show is really, really, really important and so great to have on the air. And you're a wonderful resource. So having said that, my friend has been taking domperidone for much longer than she should have for gastroparesis, and she is getting off of it now and having panic attacks. She says tight chest, heart racing. And I was just wondering if you knew anything that she could, I mean, any dietary thing that she could do to help counteract those symptoms?
Well, okay. First of all, how is she getting off of it? Did she just stop it, or what did...
Oh, I don't, and I may not have enough details for you for this, but she didn't just quit cold turkey, but I don't know how she did it. I don't know in what fashion she tapered off.
Okay, well, that's really important. So when you're tapering off an agent, step one is the longer, and this is a little speech actually I gave, I think, yesterday to someone in reference to getting off Ativan, which is lorazepam. Different drugs take a different amount of time to alter the body, and some never do. But many drugs will... essentially, the ones most particularly that act on the brain have a tendency to do this. So this is being used. It's very brain active. It's essentially a kind of a analog of prolactin, and it's often used in to help with breastfeeding. But it's also an anti-nausea drug, and it acts on the brain by attaching to a receptor. And whenever you have a drug that does that, and you take the drug over time, the body tries to balance the presence of an increased amount of the drug or neurohormone by lowering the number of receptors, because the body is always seeking to balance and center itself. So if you introduce an imbalance, which is to say a pharmaceutical, the body will try to adapt to that imbalance. And in this case, you downregulate receptors. Once those receptors are downregulated, you have to get them to come back by lowering the amount of the compound that is the ligand. That is to say, if you think a lock and a key, if the drug is the key, what's happened is you've reduced the number of available locks. So you want to reduce the available number of keys very slowly, and the body will start to regrow new locks because, again, it's seeking balance, and you've shifted the balance. So moving to some other she was using it, you said, for gastroparesis.
Right.
So moving to other pro-motility agents, and, you know, there are like another old pro-motility agent that everyone's scared to use, which is, I think, that's because they're scared to use it in the United States. They don't have a problem in Europe. That's because Europe doesn't sue you for random crap, whereas here, if you happen to be standing nearby and, you know, somebody gets a cold, it's your fault. At least you could be sued for it. Whether or not you lose doesn't really matter, because it's the getting sued that doctors dread. So a lot of defensive medicine. Reglan isn't used anymore, probably should be used a lot more than it is. And the that's metoclopramide. So in some cases, clinically, with a situation like this, I might cross the person, put them on a different pro-motility agent, and then back them off of the one they're trying to get off. She needs to go back to a dose that where she doesn't have symptoms, and then work with her doctor on how fast to drop the dose. There are some natural pro-motility agents. Stomach acid is one of them. So taking betaine hydrochloride, 5 or 6 capsules, 3,000 milligrams, whatever doesn't give her heartburn, would be a good first step to backstop that as she tries to taper. And I'm sorry, we're out of time, so we won't be able to examine the issue in any more detail. But that's what I can say right now. Go back to the minimal dose that gets rid of the side effects, and then take it down maybe 10-20% per month until you're off the agent.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I've enjoyed it very much. I've enjoyed all your calls and your emails, and I just want to ask you to keep listening. However we are putting it out, keep listening, and so long. Stay healthy.